Here is the, this is the end of the, of her little essay, which is really, really good. And I don't know whether you're going to be able to get it just from listening to the last one, but I think you get an idea of her style again on a different, in a different sphere, because she is discussing a literary subject here that has Christian connotations, of course. I had not forgotten the greatest poet, the most exact theologian, the most adult intellect of all ought chronologically to have been taken first. But I have left him to the last, because if now we are going to begin once more to take evil seriously, he is the one with whom we shall have to reckon. He was never taken in by the satanic setup, nor did his verse, that amazing and flexible instrument which could move at will and almost in a breath from the raptures of paradise, all air and fire, through the homeliest earthiness, to the extreme of infernal dirt and squalor and beastliness. Nor did his verse ever offer his reader the smallest excuse for finding the devil anything else but diabolical. Now, the reason she says this, as you know, I don't know, Milton's devil is very often considered by many people. They say, well, you know, he was really the hero of the of Paradise Lost. I don't believe that when you heard Morfitt reading Paradise Lost, you got that feeling. It was really amazing to me that listening to Paradise Lost being read aloud and getting the feeling of the poet, the poem as it was read. And I had kind of always felt that way about Satan in Paradise Lost too, and I didn't feel that way this time for some reason. Anyway, down the great sterile circles of perverse and petrified choice, hell goes narrowing to its frozen center, deep after deep. At the top are the irresponsibles who refuse choice. Below them, the people who incontinently lapsed into evil through failure to control their choice, blown on the winds or sodden in the March water of their passions. Then the deliberate hardening of the will to the choice of the wrong, made in full knowledge, the will to violence, the will to deceit. Circle below circle of fire and filth and disease, down to the ultimate treachery in which all feeling, all intellect, every conception is frozen. And fixed in the ice at the bottom, the ultimate corruption, resentful and despairing, passive and rebellious, petrifying and petrified, fixed forever in a misery without dignity, the grotesque and ghastly reality behind the facade. In a sense, he still appears not less than Archangel Ruin, but the ruin is here complete. The beauty does not shine through the corruption. It is the corruption of beauty itself. If once he was beautiful, as now he is hideous, and lifted up his brows against his maker, well may he be, the origin of all sorrow. He chose to ape the glory of the Trinity, and he has his choice. The monstrous three-headed parody lies fixed there in his inimitable self-will, champing the traitors in his jaws. The six wings of his immortal seraphhood beat savagely, powerless to lift him out of the ice of his obduracy, and increasing that ice by the wind of their beating. Hereby all Castus was frozen. With six eyes he wept, and down his three chins gushed tears and bloody foam. That is the thing at the bottom, the idiot and slobbering horror. At the entrance to his realm stand the two dreadful sentences. Here dwell the wretched people who have lost the good of the intellect, and the fearful paradox of the corrupted will. All their fear is changed into desire. That is the picture seen by the poet who took evil seriously. And we cannot evade Dante by saying that we do not believe in that particular kind of judgment after death. for he himself said that his poem was indeed literally an account of what happens in the world beyond the grave, but allegorically an account of what happens within the soul. His hell is the picture of an eternal possibility within the heart of man, and he adds that the gate to that hell always stands wide open. That's a very cheerful note to end, I thought, on. We're discussing the creativity as related to the meaning, understanding of God. And Dorothy Sears has written a book called The Mind of the Maker, which is a very, I would say attenuated in a way, but it's kind of a long process of working out and the analogy of creativity in the artist as proof of the fact of the way in which we can understand God as the maker. In other words, that if you understand the way in which, for instance, a poet or a writer produces one of his works, then you can, by analogy, you can kind of get an idea of what is understood by God as creator. In other words, that you don't think of it in terms of a scientific explanation in which evolution is always used to be the problem, nor do you think of it in terms of necessarily historical, that there were certain ages of man in which man developed in certain ways, and that this is what is described in the book of Genesis. But it's rather the understanding that as a writer creates a whole group of people with a plot and situations, and he sort of throws them at you, and you read them, and along with that reading of that, you are also introduced to ancestries of these particular people. You're introduced to their immediate past and to their early past. You're also eventually introduced to their future. Now, these are all she feels analogous to the way in which we could think about God as the creator, that he could create us in terms of all our possibilities, our history, our future, our present, the way in which an artist writes a novel or a play, or I don't think it works so well with a painter, because that's a little different, but she's thinking more in terms of linguistic arts. That if we could understand it that way, we wouldn't get so sort of hung up on trying to figure out, well, how can I believe in a God that I don't really, you know, I don't have any actual, documentary proof about him. How can I understand, how can I really say that God is true unless I can see historically so and so and so and so about him? She said if we can understand some things by analogy, we might be able to project a little bit more into the whole big concept of what it means to have a God who is a creator. And if we understand it from the point of view of the artist, we can proceed from the artist to God and see that there is a relationship here. It isn't an exact one by any means. You don't say, aha, that doesn't work. That's not true. I know God doesn't do that. I mean, she's not trying to make it that in that particularized detail. She's trying to give a generalized kind of analogy so that you get a concept and then let your imagination move in that area. It's not one that has been developed very frequently nor very much, and I think she's the a person who has written at really more has written more on it and at greater length and with more humor and more specific illustrations than anyone that I know. She does have to begin with in the first essay that we were using today, which is called Towards a Christian Aesthetic. Now, how many of you understand what aesthetics are? You say, what do you mean when you say something has an aesthetic quality? Aesthetic means something that has to do with an artistic appearance or effect. The way in which a piece of work is done, if it's aesthetically pleasing, that means it pleases you because it has a harmony, it has a beauty, it has a kind of a quality of loveliness to it that generally speaking is agreeable to people. Now, a theory of aesthetics, a whole understanding of aesthetics, now that is spelt, by the way, AESTHETICS. Aesthetics. And it's quite important that you know how to spell it and that you know what it means, because it's a word that you're going to come in contact with the rest of your life. Toward a Christian aesthetic, it's funny that you could read this essay in the book and not look up the word. I would suggest after this that when you read essays that are assigned you in whatever, well, certainly in anything that I have, I think some of the things that Carol does would maybe you'd have to be looking up a lot more words than you'd probably not get through with what you were reading. But certainly with Dorothy Sayers, I think there are a number of words in here that if you're not familiar with them, you should look them up. And when she says towards a Christian aesthetic, this is the subject that she's talking about. Now, what do you suppose that means? Towards a Christian aesthetic.
Using your art and talent and stuff like that.
What?
Using your, being able to incorporate your talents, you know, maybe the artistic line, but, you know, in the Christian life.
In the Christian life, in the way in which, all right. That's one angle, using your own talents in the life of the Christian. What about, why would you need to have a whole big thing, you know, when you say towards a Christian aesthetic, that's obviously going to be a profound statement. There's got to be something, there's quite a lot going to be involved in that. What is she involved in, do you think?
She talks about how that art is looked at more with a pagan aesthetic than a Christian aesthetic. And it's, you know, even in the church we look at art not from the Christian, with a Christian aesthetic or a Christian.
Not expressing something that is a Christian creative.
Yeah, like William Blake probably wouldn't be looked at with a Christian.
No, he wasn't, you know, in his period, certainly. And he still is not really considered amongst the church artists. That's right. Scott? Were you going to say something?
No.
The idea of a pagan idea of art or aesthetics in terms of Christianity comes from a rather obvious thing if you stop to think of it. Why do you suppose we wouldn't really get excited about Christian aesthetics, so called, or an aesthetic kind of Christian, like a Like if you were going to say, that Vespers was so aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about that? Do you think that is likely to be a positive statement about that Vespers or a negative one? Well, of course, the way I said it sounded like it was positive. It sounded like I was, really giving it a lot. But I mean, supposing somebody said that was a very aesthetic Vespers. What do you think about that in terms of a critique on something that purports to be a Christian expression or an expression of the Christian, of the gospel, or some kind of, way in which you want to communicate the gospel?
Generally, I think people would take that as a sarcastic remark, or else they think of it as a negative thing, as something that was sort of watering down its meaning. If it appealed to your senses in that way, then it obviously really didn't have much, actual substance.
That's our tendency, is to feel like something that's aesthetic is just appealing on a sort of a superficial level. That is, it may not be so superficial. It may really get to you. But if it's purely aesthetic, it hasn't gotten to a kind of grips with the message. And this is one of the problems for one of the reasons for the fact that we don't have, generally speaking, there's very little real art in the church, in Christianity. I mean, you take a picture of Jesus is the one that everybody, identifies as, oh, that's Jesus, is usually the head of Christ that is done by Solomon. Or one of the others that are sort of traditional pictures. Now, they are not pictures because nobody's ever seen Jesus. But these are portrayals that have been accepted over a long period of years as being proper to the church's understanding of who Jesus is and what he looks like.
Well, wasn't it? Carol was saying the other day, kind of odd how the church won't accept any art in their church that isn't like over so many hundred years old.
Right,
they
won't
accept modern artists.
No, that's true. Because most people feel like tradition has to be sort of, you have to put a lot of gloss on whatever it is so that it is acceptable, and then when it ceases to jar you, then it's all right. Now, the interesting thing is that the subject of that art, namely Jesus Christ, as you remember we mentioned the other day when we were going through the book, was the one person who was never boring in his life, and we have managed to make extremely boring for the general public and for ourselves quite often. Boring for ourselves, because we have not allowed his explosive quality to really get through to us. And this is what Dorothy Sayers is getting at in terms of Christian art in aesthetic, is that she's trying to get, people to see that if we could get underneath, we could get a real Christian aesthetic going that would not be an escape or a damage or a blockage to the gospel, but could be an expression of the gospel in a real way. If you look on, I think we better look at right away at 69, the beginning of the third paragraph. The fact that the church as a body has never made up her mind about the arts, it's hardly too much to say that she has never tried. She has, of course, from time to time, puritanically denounced the arts as irreligious and mischievous, or tried to exploit the arts, and by exploiting them, she means using the arts as propaganda. Exploit the arts as a means to the teaching of religion and morals. But I shall hope to show you that both these attitudes are false and degrading, and are founded upon a completely mistaken idea of what art is supposed to be and do. There have, of course, been plenty of writers on aesthetics who happen to be Christians, but they seldom made any consistent attempt to relate their aesthetic to the central Christian dogmas. Indeed, so far as European aesthetic is concerned, one feels it would probably have developed along precisely the same lines had there never been an incarnation to reveal the nature of God, that is to say, the nature of all truth. But that is fantastic. If we commit ourselves to saying that the Christian revelation discovers to us the nature of all truth, then it must discover to us the nature of the truth about art, among other things. In other words, if you're going to say that oh well, Christianity doesn't have anything to say about aesthetics, it doesn't have anything to say about art, it has nothing to say about all this kind of expression, you're saying, well, there's a whole body of truth that of course Christianity is only concerned about how you live. Well, I mean, how do you live? You don't live with any kind of art? You don't have any kind of expression like that? Oh, well, what I mean is morally. Well, morally, okay. Was Jesus, remember we just discussed Blake, and remember how he rammed home the fact that morality was not the end all of what Jesus was talking about. I mean, he went beyond just what we understand by morality and said it's much bigger than that. God's love includes a greater circumference than just certain thou shalt and thou shalt nots. And it wasn't, and Blake didn't get those ideas, as you know, from his own head. They come, strangely enough, from the New Testament. And Jesus was continually thrusting home to people that life and the abundance of it was what God wanted for his creatures, and the only way that you could get it was by living in the forgiveness of sins. And by living in that forgiveness, then you understood what mercy meant and what living before God meant. All these things were part of what Jesus was talking about, that it wasn't just a confined kind of morality that he was referring to, but a huge creative kind of life that would include art and science and wisdom, moral and ethical philosophy. It would include everything, because all of life belongs to him. And when you start, you know, categorizing or marking off little lines and saying, well, that he doesn't have anything to do with, that he doesn't have anything to do with, then you're just like the scientists who say, well, I think there are two kinds of truth, and you know, I believe this over here, but of course I go to church and worship in this place because I believe very strongly that what they talk about is true here. But they never try to make a bridge between the two, that the same God who is the creator of their church worship, of their Sunday worship, is also the creator of their laboratory. I mean, they're afraid to make any kind of relationship between the two. And I continually declare and insist and propound the conviction that God does not have to be protected from anybody or anything. He's bigger than anybody in this world or in this room or in the minds of anybody's parents in this room. Far bigger. And you don't have to protect him from any of your preconceived notions or ideas, because he's so much greater than any of us. And therefore, when people feel like they have to kind of, you know, say, well, art doesn't belong, or science doesn't belong, or this doesn't belong, or that doesn't belong, you're saying to yourself that you can cut God up into pieces. You can't, and I can't. He defies cutting up, because he's one huge whole, and Jesus Christ is his manifestation to us. And the great thing about Dorothy Sayers and the writers that we talk about in the Inkling group is that they understood this. And the strange thing is that they were extremely biblical and scriptural in their whole understanding of Jesus Christ and in their whole understanding of life, and at the same time that they could develop a strong understanding and expression of aesthetics, as she talks about here, a strong kind of imaginative life and expression, which we find in their writings, and also a very strict adherence to ethical principles, so that you don't throw the bathwater out with the baby. In other words, you don't get all imaginative and then run off and leave your wife, or dump your kids because you feel like you're supposed to be devoted to a life of something else, which happens to a lot of people who are so-called religious fanatics or devoted to God in some particular way. There's always the ethical tension and demand and responsibility, as well as a desire for expressing the love of God in a creative way, and understanding that God is great, and his greatness can only be in a small measure expressed by what we have to say and do. And Dorothy Sears is very clear on this, and that's why I if you don't read it tomorrow, I'll give you a test. And of course, you won't get any grades on it, but I'll know. If you look down in the next, sort of toward the end of that first paragraph on page 70, she talks about the fact that it's absurd to go placidly along explaining art in terms of a pagan aesthetic and taking no notice whatever, of the complete revolution of our ideas about the nature of things that occurred or should have occurred after the first Pentecost. I will go so far as to maintain that the extraordinary confusion of our minds about the nature and function of art is principally due to the fact that for nearly 2,000 years we have been trying to reconcile a pagan, or at any rate a Unitarian aesthetic, with a Christian, that is, a Trinitarian and incarnational theology. Even that makes us out too intelligent. We have not tried to reconcile them, we've merely allowed them to exist side by side in our minds. And where the conflict between them became too noisy to be overlooked, we have tried to silence the clamor by main force, either by brutally subjugating art to religion, or by shutting them up in separate prison cells and forbidding them to hold any communication with one another. Now, why do you think that she says that we are not aware of in art, in our Christianity, of an incarnational theology? What do we understand by an incarnational theology? Michael? Who is the incarnation for us? Jesus Christ is, isn't he? Well, incarnation is the fleshing in. Carnis is the Latin word for flesh. And in fleshing is what the incarnation is about. In other words, God infleshed himself amongst us so that we could actually get an idea, because God is spirit and truth. And you know, who has spirit and truth? Not us. We've got to have something that actually we can see or understand in terms of a human being. And that's what the incarnation is involved in. Incarnational theology is a theology that's concerned about the incarnation. It's concerned about the fact that Jesus Christ walked around on this earth. He didn't walk around on Paralandra or on the on Mars or some other place. He walked on this planet with feet and hands and did all the things we do. That's the incarnation theology. Now, the how does that relate, do you think, to art? How would that relate to art? I mean, if you kind of don't see Christianity, or if you don't see your religion as having this fleshing in feeling, this actual body language, and I don't mean body language in its psychological manifestation, I'm talking about body language in terms of the kind of body language Jesus was. Now, if you understand it that way, why would art have something to do with that?
just from the point of view of not from any big thing up here, but I mean, why would you think that if you believed that God had something specific to do with a person, with the trees, with taking drinks of water out of a spring, with having a picnic, all these things, why would you think that art would have something to do with that? Do you think do you think that the creation is important in if you understand Christianity as incarnation, as the importance of the flesh, the importance of human beings? So it does a lot of creating on its own. And what does it use usually for its symbols and for its materials?
The creation.
The creation, doesn't it? Use the what?
A real expression of reality.
Well, reality is...
In the creation of being reality.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you see a tree and you talk about a tree, and a tree is, it may be in a way off kind of way you say it, but still the tree has been celebrated. You celebrate a person. You celebrate a river. You celebrate a mountain. Whatever it is that you're writing about, this is where the incarnation makes a difference, because you understand then that creation was good, that God made something good. And when, if you understand it from the point of view of the incarnation, that God was willing to become one of us, that he actually celebrated humanness and human beingness, then all the things that have to do with us have to do with God and his relationship with us, and therefore we can celebrate it in art. Now, if you believe that there isn't any such relationship, if God is just dwells up there and never came down to earth, never related to his physical world, then you might not feel like there was anything to have art about. Because that is if you were religious. Because it wouldn't have anything specific to do with the God that you know. But the God that we know is in Jesus Christ. And if you know him in Jesus Christ, that is a specific, concrete kind of thing. It's not an airy-fairy, far-away philosophy. But it's a real... He was a real person. And he walked with real feet on real ground and ate real food, drank real wine, talked to real people. Well, then... When you are expressing your life, that can be done in art because it's part of your relationship with him. You see what I mean? You understand what I'm getting at? I don't know. You look like you're still asleep. I'll talk about it again because it's, you know, if it's the first time you've ever hit this, it's kind of hard to swallow it all. But And it is true, as she says, this has not been the way in which we have understood art, because the Puritans all felt that art was a real hampering of the religious life. In fact, they didn't even allow violins or music in their services because they felt that it was it took away from the real meaning of what the gospel had to give you. Well, you see, the thing is, it is possible, as Kierkegaard says, you can get lost in the aesthetics so much that you don't get into the fact that this is an expression of something real and is a rich and enriching experience, not just a way out, away from the reality of the gospel. So she talks about this in quite a great extent, and works it out really fairly well. And I'd like, you can't skim through Dorothy Sayers. She is a tough gal, and And I'm glad she is. I've got a lot of respect for her. I'm glad that the one woman we're studying is kind of hard to get, because, I mean, she's not purposely obtuse, but she is a sound thinker. And a lot of us, I have a hard time with her, you know, so I'm sure you do. I think that she has a very good analogy here that I'd like to have you look at on the top of page 71, because this is a problem. This is something that I think we all run into. She's talking about the fact that that a lot of people, when they're talking about art, they have such a lot of really crazy ideas. She says, what artists chatter about to the world and to each other is not, as a rule, their art, but the technique of their art. They will tell you, as critics, how it is they produce certain effects. The poet will talk about assonance, alliteration, and meter. The painter about perspective, balance, and how he mixes his colors, etc. And from that, we may get the misleading impression that the technique is the art, or that the aim of art is to produce some sort of effect. But this is not so. We can't go for a march unless we've learned through long practice how to control the muscles of our legs. I think she should think also about hikes, but I don't think she went on very many hikes. I think she always thought about the military background of England and the fact that they were, you know, that was what you thought about soldiers, and even in school the girls learned to do the same thing. And while it is a fact that certain tricks produce effects, like Tennyson's use of vowels and consonants to produce the effect of a sleepy murmuring in the moan of doves in immemorial elms, or of metallic clashing in the bare black cliff clanged round him, it is not true that the poem is merely a set of physical or even of emotional effects. For the moment, I only want to stress the difference between aesthetic and art and make it clear that a great artist will produce great art even though the aesthetic of his time may be hopelessly inadequate to explain it. And that's what we learned last week when we were discussing Blake, that his period of time was completely blind as to who he was and what he had to say. And not least because the church was so opposed to him, but also because the artists were, the general critics. He, you know, Reynolds and Gainsborough were the big guys in the art of that period, and he just spent all his time criticizing them and saying what terrible painters they were and how awful they were. And now, who looks at those people, the little boy in blue and stuff? You know, it's something that your grandmother has on her kitchen wall and wishes, you know, that the children would look like that now. But you know, that's not where it's at as far as art is concerned. Blake is where it's at. He's the person that people are still looking at and really excited about, because he had grasped something that was eternal in its scope and in its whole meaning. And so you can't, it's like John 5:44, how can you then believe if you seek honor one from another and seek not the honor that comes from God alone? I mean, if you're going to be depending on what people in your particular time tell you about yourself in terms of your art or what you're going to do with your life, you know, and you're not living as before God and trying to figure out, you know, where does he want me to use my talents regardless of what other people think, if you're going to be depending on the group around you, then you're going to be looking always at the lowest common denominator, because those are the people that make their voice felt. It's a big group of people. They all holler and say, "Oh no, you can't do that," because it's not being done. She discusses Plato's views of art, because they do have a lot to do with the understanding of why we have trouble with art and in the whole tradition of what is right and ethical so to do. I don't know how many of you know much about Plato, but it's not Plato, it's Plato. And he, but they do sound like, because of the way we pronounce T. We don't say Plato, which we should. We say Plato. And why shouldn't people think it's Plato? Because that's what it sounds like. That's how badly our pronunciation gets corrupted. And I heard myself saying it, so I know I said Plato. Plato. But she discusses it, and I think that just because I... Because you probably don't. Do you know? Have you ever read? Do you know anything about Plato's idea of the cave? Have you studied that? You two have. How many else? You have. Okay. You run into the symbol of the cave very often. it's the understanding of the Platonic idea of the forms, which all the way through literature. You'll find it referred to, and you'll say, oh yeah, Platonic forms, yeah. And then that's where it'll be left, because most of us don't really pursue to the end what the original source of something is. And that's why I thought I would just read you a little bit from a kind of, it's pretty much in Plato's words. And gives you an idea of what this particular sort of parable or symbol was. The interesting thing is that Plato was opposed to poetry and art, and this is why I'm telling you about it, because one of the hangovers that we've had from the Platonic tradition in our Western culture of Christianity has been the fact that Plato felt that art was a bad influence on the ethical man, and he did not feel that the statesman and the person who was going to govern the state should have much to do with art. He felt that art as such had an enfeebling effect, enervating, emasculating. It took strength out of a person, because you listen to a lot of either tawdry things, which was the lower kind of Greek poetry, but he didn't stay there. He really, you know, he zeroed right in on Homer. And you know, when you zero in on Homer in the Greek tradition, you're really into the center of things. And for a long time, he said, Socrates said, I don't think I should say anything about Homer, because he's such a, you know, he's such a household word. I better not mention him. And so he would talk all around him in terms of the problem and the danger and the falsity of poetic art. But finally, he did name names, and then he gave them what he felt they should have. You can see why he was... put to death, because he did do a lot of things that were not according to what the people in the group wanted him to do.
Is this what you're going to read, the allegory of the cave?
Mm-hmm.
What's
it's from
an allegory?
An allegory is a story that doesn't give you, that gives you a similar, it tells a whole story that's similar to a truth that somebody else that you know to be true. But because I don't think you're going to get it if I tell you just exactly the way it is, I'm going to tell you in another form and give names and personalities to the actions or ideas that are part of that original idea that I had, and I want you to get it in a different way. So I'm going to tell it in the form of a story, but obviously it's going to be pointing to the moral or the truth that I had in mind, that I have in mind, and you're going to be able to get that connection.
Just looking for symbolism and stuff.
Somewhat, there are symbols. But the whole thing is a worked out, continuous kind of of, it doesn't have to have a plot, it doesn't have to be that long a story, but it has to have a, it's a worked out kind of, section of some particular truth that you want to put into a form that somebody's going to be able to get, because you might not be able to get it if you got it in the original way in which that person thought about it. There are so many different ways in which this can be done. Now, Jesus told parables. Those weren't allegories. Those were parables. Those were stories that illustrated something. But he didn't put it back and forth in exactly the same way. An allegory is much more, deals much more with abstractions originally. The original is usually an abstraction, and then the allegory helps to make it into something that can be understandable to somebody else. But I'll just read this little bit to you, because this gives you an idea, and I think it's a good thing for you to know what this is about, because Plato's idea of the cave and the forms is an important one in Western tradition, and certainly in the coming from the Greek classical tradition. And now Socrates begins the famous parable, which he calls a parable, although I still feel like it's sort of allegorical. Compare our nature from the point of view of paideia and lack of paideia to an experience like this. He imagines men in an underground cave which has a broad entrance open to the light. Now, it's quite important that you understand the physical setup of this thing, because it has a lot to do with the understanding of the shadows and the way in which people refer to this later when they talk about the cave and the meaning of the forms. These people have been chained down there since childhood, down in this cave, by their legs and neck, so that they cannot move and cannot turn around and look behind them. In other words, they're just like that, just perfectly straight, so that there's no way that they can get any whole picture of anything. They have their backs to the entrance. Above and behind them, some distance off, a fire is burning. Its rays fall above the heads of the prisoners on the back wall of the cave towards which they are looking. I was trying to figure out, Koinonia would be a good cave. I was trying to think which, probably that would be a good opening. And then we, if that were the wall, we'd be looking there, and there'd be a fire someplace so that you'd get some light up there. Between them and the fire, there is a road along which runs a low wall, like the stage of a marionette theater, upon which conjurers show their puppets. Behind the wall, there are people carrying along all sorts of objects and figures made of wood and stone, some talking and others silent. The objects show above the wall. In other words, they're like a bunch of moving shadows on that area. And the fire throws their shadows onto the back wall. The prisoners cannot turn around, so that they have never seen anything all their lives except shadows. They naturally take the shadows for reality, and the echoes of the voices for the speech of the shadow figures. You see, he believed that this was Plato's understanding of the origin of thought and life and the life of man. That this is where man lives until he is transformed into the what he calls the life of paideia, but which is all Blake would probably call the life of the imagination. Now, if one of them was released from his chains and compelled to climb up and look towards the light, he would not be able, because of the dazzling brightness, to see the things whose shadows he used to look at. And he would not believe it if anyone told him everything he had seen hitherto was all nonsense, while he was now looking at a world of higher reality. In other words, these guys that have been, you know, chained down all their lives, if one of them happened to get out and, you know, get up and actually see what really was going on, if he came back and told these other people, you know, look, you guys don't know that there really is something up there. There's some real things. There's real life. They aren't just shadows. There are real action. That's where the real ideas are, up there. And he'd come back there and they'd say, it just can't be. We know it's not true. Because we've seen these. This is all there is, you know. Well, after all, that's where they were at, you know, with their necks and their legs chained, and they couldn't see anything else. Now, you can see lots of analogies to a lot of things in life when you think about this, because that's the way an awful lot of people, you know, look at you when you tell them about, you know, that you really love poetry, you really, really, really got into something that you really like, and they say, "Oh, no way, you know, that's not got anything." Yeah, I know, it's just a lot of stuff you've had to learn. And you can't explain to that person unless that person comes up and goes through the same thing you do. Instead, he would be quite convinced that the shadow pictures he used to see were the true reality, and he would turn away with smarting eyes into the cave once more. This is what he says happens to people who come back to the place where they can try to talk to people, and then they think, I don't want to stay in that world. That couldn't be real. It's much easier to stay where I'm chained down and where I only have certain things to look at. I don't have to make up my mind about anything. And so they would rather stay back there because what Socrates calls the smarting eyes of relating to the sun is too much for them. You see? And this is what he's trying to get at. Now this is really, I'm getting on a long thing on Plato that has something to do with Dorothy Sayers, but it isn't directly. The forms is what she's concerned about. He would need long practice before he would see the upper world. At first he would be able to see only shadows, and then the reflections of men and things in water, then much later the men and things themselves. Thereafter he would look at the sky and stars at night, and finally he would be able to gaze at the sun. And for Socrates and Plato, the sun was the great center. When you could look at the sun, that was, you know, that was where sort of the symbol of truth was. Not its reflection in water or elsewhere, but itself in its purity and in its right place. Then he would recognize that it is the sun which produces the changing seasons and the years and controls everything in the visible world and is somehow the cause even of the things which he and his fellow prisoners used to see. And then he goes on to say that then he is so converted to this new wisdom and to the excitement of living in this light, and so he decides definitely that he should go back to the prison house, to the cave, and really get these people out of their chains. And he just feels like he's got to, and he's sure that now if he comes back, of course they're going to want it. They're going to want to know about the same thing he does. Well, he says this. Now, supposing there were honors and distinctions for the prisoner who was best at recognizing the shadows as they glided past, and at remembering which of them came first and which last, and which came together, so that he could best foretell which were coming. Plato is thinking of the politician who works purely by experience. The freed prisoner would scarcely yearn to return and envy his comrades their honors. Instead, like Homer's Achilles, he would prefer to work as a lowly serf in the upper world of reason rather than be king in the world of shadows. But if he went down again into the cave and tried to compete with the others at identifying the shadows as before, he would be ridiculous because he would be unable to see in the dark. What happens when you come in from the sun? Remember how black, even a lighted room, it's so black that you just, you know, it's like you have to close your eyes for a while in order to be able to see. His fellows would say he had spoiled his eyes while up above. And if he tried to set them free and take them up, they would kill him if they could get hold of him. Now, this is the basis of the idea of the shadows. Now, the reason that I read this to you about Plato's argument about the fact that all these forms that you see are not the reality. They're just shadows. They're not the real thing. But I wanted to close with this one little quote from T.S. Eliot, because it's really, I think it's kind of neat. On page 79, she's explaining how the poet has, what the poet does with the work of art, and how he will say that my poem is the expression of my experience. But if you then say, what experience? He will say, I can't tell you anything about it except what I've said in the poem. The poem is the experience. The Son and the Father are one. The poet himself did not know what his experience was until he created the poem, which revealed his own experience to himself. To save confusion, let us distinguish between an event and an experience. An event is something that happens to one. And a lot of people say, oh, that was a real happening. Or the Holden Village, that's a happening. Well, that might be. You know, that's okay. It could be a happening. But if you don't experience it yourself, if you don't appropriate it and, you know, it doesn't digest and move around in your blood, that event is still outside. To take an extreme instance, suppose you're hit on the head and get a concussion. And as often happens when you come to, you cannot remember the blow. The blow on the head certainly happened to you, but you did not experience it. All you experience is the after effects. You only experience a thing when you can express it, however haltingly, to your own mind. Now this is something that always, well now, you know, that means, what does language have to do with thinking? I went way back to Piaget to find out which came first, the word or the thought, you know, instead of the chicken or the egg. When you are thinking about something, can you really think about it without putting it into words? Not to somebody else necessarily, but I mean, to kind of get some kind of concretion for that thought. Does it really have substance until you've expressed it in some way to yourself, so you pinned it down? Well, there are symbols that people, they say, well, you know, an early tribe uses symbols for words, and they become the kind of language for them. But it's difficult to put abstractions or kind of a thought into symbols unless they have a connected memory for you, so that you can kind of put them together, and that's what language is. You may remember the young man in T.S. Eliot's play, The Family Reunion, who says to his relations, "You are all people to whom nothing has happened, at most a continual impact of external events." He means that they have got through life without ever really experiencing anything, because they've never tried to express to themselves the real nature of what has happened to them. A poet is a man who not only suffers the impact of external events, but experiences them. And then he does that for us, so that not only he, but we ourselves recognize that experience as our own. And then she goes on to explain the word recognize and how important that is in our vocabulary of the imagination. We're going to stop there because it's 4:30 and I really kept on very long.